Song laughed. Perhaps it was the same crew who fed you to the sharks.
Dr. Song woke the minister, and together, the three concocted a story to mitigate their failure. Dr. Song believed that they should depict their talks as a complete success until, as they were about to agree on the deal, a higher power interceded via a phone call.
It will be assumed this is the American president, and Pyongyang's anger will be redirected from us to a meddlesome, vexing figure.
Together, they practiced timelines, rehearsed key moments, and repeated significant American phrases. The phone was brown. It sat on a tall stool. It rang three times. The senator only spoke four words into it. Yes, certainly. Of course. The trip back seemed to take twice as long. Jun Do fed the puppy a half-eaten breakfast burrito. Then it disappeared under all those seats and proved impossible to find. When darkness came, he could see the red and green lights of other distant jetliners. Once everyone was asleep, and there was no life on the plane but the pilots smoking in the glow of their instruments, Comrade Byuk sought him out.
"Here's your DVD," he said. "The best movie ever made."
Jun Do turned the case in the faint light. "Thanks," he said. But then he asked, "Is this a story of triumph or of failure?" Comrade Byuk shrugged.
"They say it's about love," he said. "But I don't watch black and white films."
Then he looked more closely at Jun Do.
"Hey, look, your trip wasn't a failure, if that's what you're thinking."
He pointed into the dark cabin where Dr. Song was asleep, puppy in his lap.
"Don't you worry about Dr. Song," Comrade Byuk said. "That guy's a survivor. During the war, he got an American tank crew to adopt him. He helped the GIs read the road signs and negotiate with civilians. They gave him tins of food, and he spent the whole war in the safety of a turret. That's what he could do when he was only 7.
"Are you telling me this to reassure me or yourself?" Jun Do asked. Comrade Byuk seemed not to hear this. He shook his head and smiled.
"How the hell am I going to get these fucking motorcycles off the plane?"
In darkness, they set down on the uninhabited island of Krasnatov to refuel. There were no landing lights, so the pilots dead-reckoned the approach and then lined up by the purple glow of the moonlit strip. 2,000 kilometers from the nearest land, the station had been built to service Soviet sub-hunting planes. In the shed that held the pump batteries was a coffee can. Here, Comrade Byuk placed a sheaf of $100 bills, then helped the pilots with the heavy Jet A-1 hoses. While Dr. Song slept on the plane, Jun Do and Comrade Byuk smoked in the crackling wind. The island was nothing more than 3 fuel tanks and a strip surrounded by rocks glazed white with bird guano and littered with chips of multicolored plastic and beached drift nets. Comrade Byuk's scar glowed in the moonlight.
"Nobody's ever safe,"
Comrade Byuk said, and gone was his jovial sidekick tone. Behind them, the old Ilyushin's wings drooped and groaned as they took on their payload of fuel.
"But if I thought someone on this plane was headed to the camps," he added, turning to Jun Do to make sure he was being heard, "I'd smash his head on these rocks myself."
The pilots pulled the blocks and spun the plane, nose into the wind. They cycled the engines, but before lifting over the dark, choppy water, they opened the bilge, slopping out all the plane's sewage in a midnight streak down the runway. They crossed China in darkness, and with dawn, they flew above the train tracks leading south from Shenyang, following them all the way to Pyongyang. The airport was north of the city, so Jun Do could get no good look at the fabled capital with its May Day Stadium, Mansudae Mausoleum, and flaming red Tower of Chuche. Ties were straightened, the trash picked up, and finally Comrade Byuk brought Jun Do the puppy, which his men had crawled the length of the cabin to capture. But Jun Do wouldn't take the dog.
"It's a gift for Sun Moon," he said. "Will you get it to her for me?"
Jun Do could see the questions moving through Comrade Byuk's eyes, but he voiced none of them. Instead, Comrade Byuk offered a simple nod. The landing gear was lowered, and on approach, the goats on the runway somehow knew the moment to wander away. But touching down, Dr. Song saw the vehicles that were waiting to meet the plane, and he turned, panic on his face.
"Forget everything," he called to the minister and Jundo. "The plan must completely change."
"What is it?" Jundo asked. He looked at the minister, whose eyes showed fear.
"There's no time," Dr. Song said. "The Americans never intended to return what they stole from us. You got that? That's the new story."
They huddled in the galley, bracing themselves as the pilots leaned hard on the brakes.
"The new story is this," Dr. Song said. "The Americans had an elaborate plan to humiliate us. They made us do groundskeeping and cut the senator's weeds, yes?"
"That's right," Jundo said. "We had to eat outside, with our bare hands surrounded by dogs." The minister said,
"There was no band or red carpet to greet us, and they drove us around in obsolete cars."
"We were shown nice shoes at a store, but then they were put away," Jundo said. "At dinner, they made us wear peasant shirts." The minister said,
"I had to share my bed with a dog."
"Good, good," Dr. Song said. He had a desperate smile on his face, but his eyes sparkled with the challenge.
"This will speak to the dear leader. This might save our skins."
The vehicles on the runway were Soviet Sears, three of them. The Crows were all manufactured in Chongjin at the Sungli 58 factory, so Jundo had seen thousands of them. They were used to move troops and cargo, and they had hauled many an orphan. In the rainy season, a Sear was the only thing that could move at all. Dr. Song refused to look at the Crows or their drivers smoking together on the running boards. He smiled broadly and greeted the two men who were there to debrief them. But the minister, grim-faced, couldn't stop staring at the tall truck tires, the drum fuel tanks. Jundo suddenly understood that if someone were to be transported from Pyongyang to a prison camp, only a Crow could get you over the bad mountain roads. Jundo could see the giant portrait of the great leader Kim Il-sung atop the airport terminal. But the two debriefers led them in a different direction. Past a group of women in jumpsuits who faced a pile of shovels as they did their morning calisthenics, and past a plane whose fuselage lay on the ground, blowtorched into four sections. Old men seated on buckets were stripping the copper wire from it. They came to an empty hangar, voluminous inside. Potholes in the cement floor were pooled with muddy water. There were several mechanics bays filled with tools, lifts, and workbenches, and Dr. Song, the minister, and Jundo were each placed in one, just out of sight of one another. Jundo sat at a table with the debriefers, who began going through his things.
"Tell us about your trip," one said. "And don't leave anything out."
There was a hooded typewriter on the table, but they made no move to use it. At first, Jundo only mentioned the things they'd agreed upon. The indignities of dogs, the paper plates of eating under the hot sun. As he spoke, the two men opened his bourbon and drinking, both approved. They divided his cigarettes right in front of him. They seemed especially fond of the little flashlight, and they interrupted him to make sure he wasn't hiding another. They tasted his beef jerky, tried on his calfskin gloves.
"Start again,"
the other one told him,
"and say it all."
He kept listing the humiliations, how there was no band at the airport, no red carpet, how Tommy had left his spoor in the back seat. Like animals, they had been made to eat with their bare hands. He tried to remember how many bullets had been fired from the old guns. He described the old cars. Did he mention the dog in his bed? Could he have a glass of water? No time, they said. Soon this would be over. One debriefer turned the DVD in his hand.
"Is this high definition?"
he asked. The other debriefer waved him off.
"Forget it,"
he said.
"That movie's black and white."
They snapped several pictures with the camera, but could find no way to view them. "It's broken," Jundo said.
"And these?"
they asked, holding up the antibiotics. "Female pills," Jundo told them.
"You'll have to give us your story,"
one of them said.
"We'll need to get all of it down," We're going to be right back, but while we're gone, you should practice. We'll be listening. We'll be able to hear everything you say.
Start to finish, the other man said. Where do I start? Jun Do asked him. Did the story of his trip to Texas begin when the car came for him? Or when he was declared a hero, or when the second mate drifted off into the waves? And finish? He had a horrible feeling that this story was nowhere near finished.
Practice,
the debriefer said. Together, they left the repair bay, and then he could hear the muffled echoes of the minister now telling his story. A car came for me, Jun Do said aloud. It was morning. The ships in the harbor were drying their nets. The car was a Mercedes, four-door, with two men driving. It had windshield wipers and a factory radio. He spoke to the rafters. Up there, he could see birds bobbing their heads as they looked down upon him. The more detailed he made his story, the more strange and unbelievable it seemed to him. Had Wanda really served him iced lemonade? Had the dog actually brought him a rib bone after his shower? When the debriefers returned, Jun Do had only recited his story to the part about first opening the cooler of tiger meat on the plane. One of them was listening to the minister's iPod, and the other one looked upset. For some reason, Jun Do's mouth went back to the script. There was a dog on the bed, he said. We were forced to cut brush. The seat had been spoored.
You sure you don't have one of these?
One asked, holding up the iPod.
Maybe he's hiding it. Is that true? Are you hiding it?
The cars were ancient, Jun Do said. The guns dangerously old. The first story kept coming back into his mind, and he became paranoid that he might accidentally say that the phone had rung four times, and the senator had said three words into it. Then he remembered that was wrong. The phone had rung three times, and the senator had spoken four words. And then Jun Do tried to clear his mind because that was wrong. The phone never rang. The American president didn't call at all.
Hey, snap out of it, one of the debriefers said. We asked the old man where his camera was, and he said he didn't know what we were talking about. You all got the same gloves and cigarettes and everything.
There's nothing else, Jun Do said. You've got everything I own.
We'll see what the third guy says.
They handed him a piece of paper and a pen.
It's time to get it down,
they said, and left the bay again. Jun Do picked up the pen. A car came for me, he wrote, but the pen barely had any ink in it. He decided to skip to where they were already in Texas. He shook the pen and added, and took me to a boot store. He knew the pen only had one more sentence in it. By pressing hard, he scratched out, here my humiliations began. Jun Do lifted the paper and read his two-sentence story. Dr. Song had said that what mattered in North Korea was not the man, but his story. What did it mean, then, when his story was nothing, just a suggestion of a life? One of the crow drivers entered the hangar. He came to Jun Do, asked him,
you the guy I'm taking?
Taking where? Jun Do asked. A debriefer came over.
What's the problem?
He asked.
My headlights are shut, the driver said. I have to go now or I'll never make it.
The debriefer turned to Jun Do.
Look, your story checks out, he said. You're free to go.
Jun Do lifted the paper. This is all I got, he said. The pen ran out of ink. The debriefer said,
all that matters is that you got something. We sent your actual paperwork in already. This is just a personal statement. I don't know why they make us get them.
Do I need to sign it?
Couldn't hurt,
the debriefer said.
Yes, let's make it official. Here, use my pen.
He handed Jun Do the pen Dr. Song had been given from the mayor of Vladivostok. The pen wrote beautifully. He hadn't signed his name since language school.
Better take him now, the debriefer told the driver. Or he'll be here all day. The one old guy asked for extra paper.
He gave the driver a pack of American Spirit cigarettes, then asked the driver if he had the medics with him.
Yeah, they're in the truck,
the driver said. The debriefer handed Jun Do his DVD of Casablanca and his camera and his pills. He led Jun Do to the hangar door.
These guys are headed east, he told Jun Do, and you're going to catch a ride with them. Those medics are on a mission of mercy. They're true heroes of the people, those guys. The hospitals in the capital need them like you can't believe. So if they need help, you help them. I don't want to hear later that you were being lazy or selfish. You got that?
Jun Do nodded. At the door, though, he looked back. He couldn't see Dr. Song or the minister, the way they were tucked back in the repair bays, but he could hear Dr. Song's voice, clear and precise.
It was a most fascinating journey,
Dr. Song was saying.
Never to be repeated.
9 hours in the back of a Crow. The washboard road rattled his guts. The engine vibrated so much he couldn't tell where his flesh ended and the wooden bench began. When he tried to move, to piss through the slats to the dirt road below, his muscles wouldn't answer. His tailbone had gone from numb to fire to dumb. Dust filled the canopy, gravel shot up through the transaxles, and his life returned to enduring. Also in the back of the truck were two men. They sat on either side of a large white cooler, and they wore no insignia or uniform. They were particularly dead-eyed, and of all the shit jobs on Earth, Jun Do thought, these guys had it the worst. Still, he tried to make small talk.
So, are you guys medics?
He asked them. The truck hit a rock. The lid of the cooler lifted, and a wave of pink ice water sloshed out. He tried again.
The guy at the airport said you two were real heroes of the people.
They wouldn't look at him, the poor bastards, Jun Do thought. He'd choose a landmine crew before being tasked out to a blood-harvesting detail. He only hoped they'd get him east to Kinje before they made a stop to practice their trade, and he distracted himself by thinking of the gentle motion of the Junma, of cigarettes and small talk with the captain, of the moment he turned the dials and his radios came to life. They breezed through all the checkpoints. How the soldiers manning them could tell that a blood team was on board, Jun Do couldn't figure, but he wouldn't want to stop their truck either. Jun Do noticed for the first time that spinning in eddies of wind through the floorboards were the shells of hard-boiled eggs, a dozen of them, perhaps. This was too many eggs for a single person to eat, and nobody would share their eggs with a stranger, so it must have been a family. Through the back of the truck, Jun Do watched crop security towers flash past, a local cadre in each with an old rifle to guard the corn terraces from the farmers who tended them. He saw dump trucks filled with peasants on their way to help with construction projects. And the roads were lined with conscripts bearing huge rocks on their shoulders to shore up washed-out sections. Yet this was happy work compared with the camps. He thought of whole families being carried off together to such destinations. If children had sat where he sat, if old people had occupied this bench, then absolutely no one was safe. One day a truck like this might come for him, too. The cast-off eggshells spun like tops in the wind. There was something carefree and whimsical about their movement. When the shells drifted near Jun Do's feet, he stomped them. It was late afternoon when the truck descended into a river valley. On the near shore was a large encampment, thousands of people living in mud and squalor to be close to their loved ones on the other side. Across the bridge, everything changed. Through a flap in the black canvas, Jun Do could see harmonica-style barracks, hundreds of them, housing thousands of people, and soon the stink of distilling soy was in the air. The truck passed a crowd of small boys, stripping the bark from a stack of yew branches. They had only their teeth to start the cut, their nails to peel back a flap, and their little biceps to then rip the branch clean. Normally, a sight like this would reassure him, make him feel comfortable. But Jun Do had seen no living boy so sinewy, and they moved faster than the Long Tomorrow's orphans ever had. The gates were a simple affair. There was one man to throw a large electrical switch, while another wheeled back an electrified section of fencing. The medics removed old surgical gloves from their pockets, ones that had clearly been used many times, and pulled them on. They parked by a dark wooden building. The medics jumped out and told Jundo to carry the cooler. But he didn't move. His legs were filled with static, and he sat there, watching a woman rolling a tire past the back of the truck. Both of her legs were missing below the knee. She had a pair of work boots that she'd fashioned to wear backward, so that her short stumps went into the boots' toe boxes while her knees were planted in the heels. The boots were laced up tight, and she was surprisingly nimble in them, swinging her short legs in circles in pursuit of the tire. One of the medics picked up a handful of dirt and threw it in Jundo's face. His eyes filled with grit and welled over. He wanted to kick that punk's head off. But this was not the place to make a mistake or do anything stupid. Besides, it was all he could do to swing his legs off the back of the truck and keep his balance while he hefted the cooler. No, it was best to get this over with and get out of here. He followed the medics into a processing center, where there were dozens of infirmary cots filled with people who seemed on both sides of the edge of death. Listless and murmuring, they were like the fish at the bottom of the hold, offering no more than one last twitch of a gill when the knife came down. He saw the inward gaze of a heavy fever, the yellow-green skin of organ failure, and wounds that lacked only blood to keep bleeding. Spookiest of all, he couldn't tell the men from the women. Jundo dropped the cooler on a table. His eyes were on fire, and trying to wipe them clean with his shirt only made them burn more. He had no choice. Opening the cooler, he used the blood-laced ice water to splash the dirt from his eyes. There was a guard in the room, sitting on a crate and leaning against the wall. He threw his cigarette away to accept an American Spirit cigarette from the medics. Jundo came up to get a cigarette, too. A medic turned to the guard.
"Who is this guy?"
he asked, indicating Jundo. The guard inhaled deep on his fancy cigarette.
"Someone important enough to arrive on a Sunday," he said.
"They're my cigarettes," Jundo said, and the medic reluctantly gave him one. The smoke was rich and smooth, and it was worth a little eye sting. An old woman entered the room. She was thin and bent and wore strips of cloth wrapped around her hands. She had a large camera on a wooden tripod that looked exactly like the one the Japanese photographer was using when they kidnapped her.
"There she is,"
the guard said.
"Time to get to work."
The medics began tearing strips of tape in preparation. He was about to witness the darkest of trades, but the cigarette calmed him. Just then, something caught his eye. He looked up to the blank wall above the doorway. It was completely empty. There was simply nothing there. He pulled the camera from his pocket, and while the guard and the medics were discussing the merits of various tobacco brands, Jundo snapped a picture of the empty white wall.
"Understand that, Wanda," he thought.
Never in his life had he been in a room without portraits of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il above the door. Not in the lowliest orphanage, not in the oldest train car, not even in the burned-out shitter of the Junma. Never had he been in a place that did not merit the gaze of the dear and great leader's constant concern. The place he was in, he knew now, was below mattering. It didn't even exist. While he was pocketing his camera, he caught the old woman staring at him. Her eyes were like those of the senator's wife. He felt she was seeing something he didn't even know about himself. One of the medics yelled at Jundo to grab a crate from the corner, where there was a stack of them. Jundo took a crate and met the medic at the bedside of a woman who had her jaw tied shut with strips of cloth that circled her head. One medic began unlacing her shoes, which were just rotten tire treads wrapped with wire. The other began unwrapping tubing and intravenous lines, all precious medical supplies. Jundo touched the woman's skin, which was cool.
"I think we're too late," he told them.
The medics ignored him. They each ran a line into a vein in the tops of her feet, then attached two empty blood bags. The old photographer appeared with her camera. She called to the guard for the woman's name, and when he told her, The photographer wrote it on a gray slate and placed it on the woman's chest. Then the photographer unwound the strips of cloth from the woman's head. When the photographer removed the woman's cap, most of her hair came off with it, lining it with a black swirl.
"Here,"
the photographer said, slipping the cap to Jun Do.
"Take it."
The cap looked heavy, with ground-in grease. Jun Do hesitated.
"Do you know who I am?"
the old photographer asked.
"I'm Mong Nan. I take the pictures of all who arrive and depart from this place."
She shook the cap insistently.
"It's wool. You'll need it."
Jun Do pocketed the cap as a way to shut her up, to stop her in her crazy talk. When Mong Nan took the woman's picture, the flash awakened her for a moment. She reached from the cot to Jun Do's wrist and clenched it. In her eyes was a very clear desire to take him with her. The medics yelled at Jun Do to lift the head of the cot. When he did so, they kicked the crate underneath, and soon the four blood bags were filling nicely. Jun Do said to the medics, "We'd better work fast. It's getting dark, and that driver said he doesn't have headlights." The medics ignored him. The next person was a teenager, his chest cool and pale blue. His eyes were drawn so that they turned with labor in increments. One of his arms hung off the cot, outstretched to the rough-hewn floorboards.
"What's your name?"
Mong Nan asked him. His mouth kept making a motion as though he was trying to wet his lips before speaking, but the words never came. Soft and tender, with the voice of a mother, she whispered to the dying boy.
"Close your eyes,"
she said, and when he did, she snapped the photo. The medics used the strips of medical tape to secure the bloodlines, and the process repeated itself. Jun Do lifted the cot and slid the next crate under it. The boy's head gently lolled, and then Jun Do was left carrying the warm bags to the cooler. The life of the boy, the true life of him, had literally drained warm into these bags that Jun Do held, and it was like the boy was still alive in the bags until Jun Do personally snuffed him by dropping them into the ice water. For some reason, he expected the warm bags of blood to float, but they sank to the bottom. Mong Nan whispered to Jun Do,
"Find a pair of boots."
Jun Do gave her a wary look, but did as he was told. There was only one man with boots that might fit. The uppers had been patched many times, but the soles were from a pair of military boots. In his sleep, the man made a croaking noise, as if bubbles kept rising up his throat to pop in his mouth.
"Get them,"
Mong Nan said. Jun Do began unlacing the boots. They wouldn't make him put on a pair of work boots unless they had another ugly task in store for him. He could only hope it wasn't burying all these fucking people. While Jun Do was wriggling the man's boots off, he woke.
"Water,"
he said, before he could even open his eyes. Jun Do froze, hoping the man wouldn't come too. But the guy found his focus.
"Are you a doctor?"
the man asked.
"An ore cart tipped over. I can't feel my legs."
"I'm just helping out," Jun Do said, and it was true. When the boot slipped off, the man seemed not to notice. The man wore no socks. Several of his toes were blackened and broken, and some were missing, with the remaining stubs leaking a tea-colored juice.
"Are my legs okay?"
the man asked.
"I can't feel them."
Jun Do took the boots and backed away, back to where Mong Nan had her camera set up. Jun Do shook the boots and clapped them together, but no toes fell out. Jun Do lifted each boot and peeled back its tongue in an effort to peer as deep inside as he could, but he could see nothing. He hoped the missing toes had fallen off someplace else. Mong Nan raised the tripod to Jun Do's height. She handed him a little gray slate and a chalk stone.
"Write your name and date of birth."
"Bak Jun Do," he wrote, for the second time in one day. "My birth date is unknown," he told her. He felt like a child when he lifted the slate to his chin, like a little boy. He thought,
Why is she taking my picture? But he didn't ask this. Mongnan pressed a button, and when the flash went off, everything seemed different. He was on the other side of the bright light now, and that's where all the bloodless people on cots were. On the other side of her flash. The medics yelled at him to lift a cot.
Ignore them, she said. When they're done, they're going to sleep in the truck, and in the morning, they're going home. You. We've got to take care of you before it's too dark.
Mongnan called to the guard for the barracks number of Pak Jun Do. When he told her, she wrote it on the back of his hand.
We don't usually get people on Sundays, she said. You're kind of on your own. First thing is to find your barracks. You need to get some sleep. Tomorrow's Monday. The guards are hell on Monday.
I've got to go, he said. I don't have time to bury anybody. She lifted his hand and showed him the barracks number written across the back of his knuckles.
Hey, she said. This is you now. You're in my camera. Those are now your boots.
She started walking him toward a door. Over his shoulder, he looked for the pictures of Kim Jong-il and Kim Il-sung. A flash of panic struck him. Where were they when he needed them?
Hey!
One of the medics said.
We're not done with him.
Go, Mongnan said. I'll handle this. Find your barracks, she said, before it's too dark.
But then, what do I do then?
Do what everyone else does,
she said, and pulled from her pocket a milky white ball of corn kernels. This she gave to him.
If people eat fast, you eat fast. If they drop their eyes when someone comes around, so do you. If they denounce a prisoner, you chime in.
When Jundo opened the door, boots in hand, he looked out onto the dark camp rising in every direction into the icy canyons of a huge mountain range, its peaks still visible in the last of the setting sun. He could see the glowing mouths of the mine heads and the torchy flicker of workers moving within. Ore carts pushed forth from them under human power, strobing from security lights that reflected off the slag ponds. Everywhere, cooking fires cast an orange glow upon the harmonica houses, and the acrid smoke of green firewood made him cough. He didn't know where this prison was. He didn't even know its name.
Don't let anyone see you use that camera, Mongnan told him. I'll come find you in a couple days.
He closed his eyes. It seemed he could make out the plaintive groans of roofing metal in the evening wind, of nails squeaking in the grip of contracting wood, of human bones stiffening and hardening on 30,000 bunks. He could hear the slow swivel of searchlight tripods, and he could make out the hum of electricity charging perimeter wires, and the icy crackle of ceramic insulators on their poles. And soon he would be in the center of it, in the belly of the ship once again. But this time, there would be no surface, no hatch, just the slow, endless pitch of everything to come. Mongnan indicated the boots in his hand.
They'll try to get those from you. Can you fight?
Yeah, he said.
Then put them on,
she told him. The way you dig into a boot for old sticky toes is the way you spring a trap door in a DMZ tunnel, or pull a stranger off a beach in Japan. You just take that breath and go. Closing his eyes, Jundo breathed deeply and reached inside the dank boots, sweeping his fingers back and forth, feeling all the way in. Finally, he turned his wrist so he could scrape out the depths, and he removed what he had to remove. It left a scowl on his face. He turned to the medics, to the guard, to the doomed half-dead. I was a model citizen, he told them. I was a hero of the state, he added, and then stepped through the door in his new boots, out into a matterless place. And from this point forward, nothing further is known of the citizen named Pak Jun Do. Part 2. The
The Confessions of Commander Ga. 1 year later.
We were finalizing a month-long interrogation of a professor from Kaesong when a rumor spread through the building that Commander Ga had been apprehended and was here, in custody, in our own Division 42. Right away, we sent the interns, Kyuki and Jujak, upstairs to processing to see if this was true. Certainly, we were dying to get our eyes on Commander Ga, especially after all the stories that had been flying around Pyongyang lately. Could it be the same Commander Ga who had won the Golden Belt, who had bested Kimura in Japan, who had rid the military of homosexuals, and then married our nation's actress? But our work with the professor was at a critical stage and couldn't be abandoned for a little celebrity gawking. The professor's was a textbook case, really. He had been accused of counter-revolutionary teachings, specifically using an illegal radio to play South Korean pop songs to his students. It was a silly charge, probably just the work of a rival at his university. Such things are hard to prove one way or another. Most people in North Korea work in pairs, so there is always a co-worker ready to give evidence or denounce his partner. Not so with a professor, whose classroom is his own domain. It would have been easy to get the professor to confess, but that's not us. We don't work that way. You see, Division 42 is really two divisions. Our rival interrogation team is the Pyubyok, named after the floating wall defenders that saved Pyongyang from invaders in 1136. There are only a dozen or so Pyubyok left, old men with silver crew cuts who walk in a row like a wall and truly believe they can float, stealthy as ghosts, from one citizen to the next, interrogating them as a wind interrogates the leaves. They are constantly breaking their hands on the principle that the bones grow back stronger, knitting in extra layers. It is a terrible thing to see old men out of nowhere cracking their hands on door jams or the rims of fire barrels. The Pyubyok all gather around when one is about to break a hand, and the rest of us, the thinking, principled remainder of Division 42, have to look away. Junbi, they say almost softly, then count hana, dul, set, and shout, shijak! Then there's the weirdly dead sound of a hand striking the edge of a car door. The Pyubyok believe that all subjects arriving at Division 42 should be met with brutality right away. Senseless, extended, old-fashioned hurt. And then there's my team. Correction, our team. For it truly is a group effort. We have no need for a nickname, and sharp minds are our only interrogation tools. The Pyubyok experienced either the war or its aftermath when they were young, and their ways are understandable. We pay respect to them, but interrogation is a science now, and long-term, consistent results are what matter. Thuggery has its place, we concede, but it should come tactically, at specific moments, over a long relationship. And pain, that towering white flower, can only be used once the way we apply it. Complete, enduring, transformational pain, without cloak or guise. And since everyone on our team is a graduate of Kim Il-sung University, we have a soft spot for old professors, even our sad candidate from a regional college town in Kaesong. In an interrogation bay, we reclined our professor into one of the Q&A chairs, which are amazingly comfortable. We have a contractor in Syria who makes them for us. They're similar to dental chairs, with baby blue leather and arm and headrests. There's a machine next to the chair, though, that makes people nervous. It's called an autopilot. I suppose that's our only other tool.
I thought you had all you needed to know, the professor said. I answered the questions.
You were wonderful, we told him. Absolutely. Then we showed him the biography we made of his life. At 212 pages, it was the product of dozens of hours of interviews. It contained all of him, from his earliest memories. are the education, defining personal moments, achievements and failures, affairs with students, and so on. A complete documentation of his existence, right to his arrival at Division 42. He flipped through the book, impressed. We use a binding machine, the kind that seals the spines of doctoral dissertations, and it gives the biographies a real professional look. The pubic simply beat you until you confess to using a radio, whether there is a radio or not. Our team discovers an entire life with all its subtleties and motivations, and then crafts it into a single, original volume that contains the person himself. When you have a subject's biography, there's nothing between the citizen and the state. That's harmony. That's the idea our nation is founded upon. Sure, some of our subject stories are sweeping and take months to record. But if there's one commodity we have no shortage of in North Korea, it's forever. We hooked the professor up to the autopilot, and he looked quite surprised when the pain delivery began. The expression on his face conveyed a desperation to determine what we wanted from him and how he could give it. But the biography was complete. There were no more questions. The professor watched in horror as I reached across his body to his shirt pocket, where I removed a gold pen clipped there. Such an object can concentrate the electrical current, setting the clothes on fire. The professor's eyes, they understood now that he was no longer a professor, that he would never have need of a pen again. It wasn't long ago, when we were young, that people like the professor, probably with a handful of his students, would be shot in the soccer stadium on a Monday morning before work. While we were in college, the big trend was to throw them all into the prison mines, where life expectancy is 6 months. And of course now, organ harvesting is where so many of our subjects meet their end. It's true that when the mines open their maw for more workers, everyone must go. We have no say over that. But people like the professor, we believe, have an entire life of happiness and labor to offer our nation. So we ramp up the pain to inconceivable levels, a shifting muscular river of pain. Pain of this nature creates a rift in the identity. The person who makes it to the far shore will have little resemblance to the professor who now begins the crossing. In a few weeks, he will be a contributing member of a rural farm collective, and perhaps we can even find a widow to comfort him. There's no way around it. To get a new life, you've got to trade in your old one. For now, it was our little professor's alone time. We set the autopilot, which monitors all of a subject's vitals and brings the pain in modulated waves. And then we closed the soundproof door and made for the library. We'd see the professor again this afternoon, pupils dilated, teeth chattering, and help him step into his street clothes for the big trip to the countryside. Our library, of course, is really just a storeroom. But each time our team delivers a new biography, I like to do it with some ceremony. Again, my apologies for using that regrettable pronoun I. I try not to bring it to work with me. Shelves line the walls, floor to ceiling, and fill the room in freestanding rows. In a society where it is the collective that matters, we're the only people who make the individuals count. No matter what happens to our subjects after we interrogate them, we still have them here. We have saved them all. The irony, of course, is that the average citizen, the average interrogator walking the street, for instance, never gets his story told. Nobody asks him his favorite Sun Moon movie. Nobody wants to know, does he prefer millet cakes or millet porridge? No, in a cruel twist, it's only enemies of the state that get this kind of star treatment. With a little fanfare, we placed the professor's biography on the shelf, right next to the girl dancer from last week. She had us all weeping as she described how her little brother lost his eyes, and when the moment came to apply the autopilot to her, the pain made her limbs rise and sweep the air in rhythmic, graceful gestures, as if she were telling her story one last time through movement. You can see that interrogation isn't even the right word for what we do. It's a clumsy holdover from the Pubyok era. When the last Pubyok finally retires, we will lobby to have our name changed to Division of Citizen Biographies. Our interns Kyuki and Jujak returned out of breath. A team of Pubyok are there, Kyuki said.
They got to Commander Ga first, Jujak added.
We raced upstairs. When we got to the holding room, Sarge and some of his guys were just leaving.
Sarge was the leader of the Pubyok, and there was no love lost between us.
His forehead was prominent, and even in his 70s, he had the body of an ape. Sarge was what we called him. I never knew his real name. He stood in the doorway, rubbing one hand in the other.
"Impersonating a national hero," Sarge said, shaking his head. "What's our nation coming to? Is there any honor left at all?"
There were some marks on Sarge's face, and as he spoke, blood trickled from his nose. Kyuki touched her own nose. "Looks like Commander Ga got the best of you guys."
"That girl, Kyuki. What cheek." "It's not Commander Ga," Sarge said. "But yeah, he had a nifty little trick he pulled on us. We're sending him down to the sump tonight. We'll show him some tricks of our own."
"But what about his biography?" we asked.
"Didn't you hear me?" Sarge asked. "It's not Commander Ga. The guy's an imposter."
"Then you won't mind if our team tries its hand. We're only after the truth."
"The truth isn't in your silly books," Sarge said. "It's something you can see in a man's eyes. You can feel it here, in your heart."
Personally, I feel bad for Sarge. He was an old man of large stature. To have that kind of size meant you had eaten meat as a child, something that would most likely come from collaborating with the Japanese. Whether he had cozied up to the Japs or not, everyone he had met over his whole life probably suspected he had.
"But yeah, the guy's all yours," Sarge said. "After all, what are we without honor?"
he added, but he said the word "we" in a way that didn't include us. He started to walk away, but then turned back.
"Don't let him near the light switch," he warned.
Inside, we found Commander Ga in a chair. The Pubyok had done a number on him, and he certainly didn't look like the kind of guy who had led assassination missions into the South to silence loudmouth defectors.
He looked us over, trying to decide whether we meant to beat him as well, though he didn't seem inclined to offer any defense if we did. His busted lips looked pitiful, and his reddened ears were filling with fluid from being slapped with the soles of dress shoes. We could see old frostbite marks on his fingers, and his shirt had been torn off, revealing a tattoo on his chest of the actress Sun Moon. We shook our heads. Poor Sun Moon.
There was also a large scar on his arm,
though the rumors that Commander Ga had wrestled a bear were just that, rumors. In his rucksack, we found only a pair of black cowboy boots, a single can of peaches, and a bright red cell phone, battery dead. "We're here for your story," we told him.
His face was still ringing from Pubyok fists.
"I hope you like happy endings," he said. We helped him to an interrogation bay and into his own Q&A chair.
We gave him aspirin and a cup of water, and soon he was asleep. We scribbled off a quick note that said, "Is not Commander Ga." This, we placed in a vacuum tube, and with a whoosh,
sent it deep into the bunker complex below us, where all the decisions were made. How deep the bunker went, and who exactly was down there, we didn't know. The deeper, the better was how I felt. I mean, we felt. Before we had even turned to go, the vacuum tube had raced back and dropped into our hopper. When we opened it, the note inside read simply, "Is Commander Gaw." It was only at the very end of the day, when we were about to hang up our smocks, that we returned to him. The swelling had started on the face of Commander Gaw, or whoever he was, though there was something peaceful about his sleep. We noticed that his hands rested on his stomach, and they seemed to be typing, as if he were transcribing the dream he was having. We stared at his fingers a while, but could make no sense of what he might be writing. "We're not the ones who hurt you," we said when we woke him. "That was the work of another party. Answer a simple question for us, and we'll get you a room, a comfortable bed." Commander Gaw nodded. There were so many questions we were dying to ask him. But then our intern, Kyuki, suddenly spoke up. "What did you do with the actress's body?" she blurted out. "Where did you hide it?" We took Kyuki by the shoulder and led her out of the interrogation bay. She was the first female intern in the history of Division 42, and boy, was she a firebrand. The pubic were beside themselves that a woman was in the building. But to have a modern, forward-thinking interrogation division, a female interrogator was going to be essential. "Start slow," we told Kyuki. "We're building a relationship here. We don't want to put him on the defensive. If we earn his trust, he'll practically write his story for us." "Who cares about the biography?" she asked. "Once we find out the location of the dead actress and her kids, they'll shoot him in the street. End of story." "Character is destiny," we told her, reminding her of the famous quote from Kim Il-sung. "That means that once we discover the inside of a subject, what makes him tick, we not only know everything he's done, but everything he will do." Back in the interrogation bay, Kyuki reluctantly asked a more appropriate question. "How did you first meet the actress Sun Moon?" she asked. Commander Gaw closed his eyes. "So cold," he said. "She was on the side of the infirmary. The infirmary was white. The snow fell heavily. It blocked my view of her. The battleship burned. They used the infirmary because it was white. Inside, people moaned. The water was on fire." "He is worthless," Kyuki muttered. She was right. It had been a long day. Up top, on ground level, the rust-colored light of afternoon would be stretching long now through downtown Pyongyang. It was time to call it quits and get home before the power went out.
"Wait," Zhujiak said. "Just give us something, Commander Gaw."
The subject seemed to like being called Commander Gaw. Zhujiak went on.
"Just tell us what you were dreaming about. Then we'll take you to a room."
"I was driving a car," Commander Gaw said. "An American car."
"Yes," Zhujiak said. "Keep going. Have you really driven an American car?"
Zhujiak was one fine intern. He was the first minister's boy who had ever been worth a damn. "I have," Commander Gaw said.
"Why not start there? Why not tell us about driving an American car?"
Slowly, he began to speak. "It's nighttime," he said. "My hand shifts through the gears. The street lights are off. Electric buses are crammed with third-shift factory workers, silently racing down Chalama Street and Reunification Boulevard. Someone is in the car with me. I don't know Pyongyang. Left, she says. Right. We are driving to her house, across the river, on the heights of Mount Tesson. In the dream, I believe that this night will be different, that when we arrive home, she will finally let me touch her. She's wearing a platinum chosonot, shimmery as crushed diamonds. On the streets, people in black pajamas dart into our path. People carrying bundles and groceries and extra work to take home. But I do not slow. I am Commander Ga in the dream. My whole life, I've been steered by others. I've been the one trying to escape from their paths. But Commander Ga, he is a man who steps on the gas.
In the dream, have you just become Commander Ga? We asked him. But he kept going, as if he didn't hear us. We cut through Mansu Park, mist from the river. In the woods, families are stealing chestnuts from the trees. The children running through the branches, kicking the nuts down to parents who crack them open between rocks. Once you spotted a yellow or blue bucket, they all came into focus. Once your eyes adjusted, they were everywhere, families risking prison to steal nuts from public parks. Are they playing some kind of game? Someone asked me. They are so amusing, up in the trees in their white bedclothes. Or maybe it's athletics they're performing. You know, gymnastics. It's such a treat, this kind of surprise. What a fine movie it would make. A family of circus performers who practice in the trees of a public park at night. They must practice in secret because a rival circus family is always stealing their tricks. Can't you just picture this movie? She asked me. Up on the screen? The moment was so perfect. I would have driven off the bridge and killed us both to make that moment last forever. Such was my love for Sun Moon. A woman who was so pure, she didn't know what starving people looked like. The five of us stood there in awe of the story. Commander Ga had certainly earned his sedative. I gave QQ a look that said, "Now do you understand the subtle art of interrogation? You shouldn't be in this business if you don't find your subjects endlessly interesting. If all you want to do is rough them up." We determined that Ga was the type to tend his own wounds. So we locked him in a room with some disinfectant and a bandage. Then we traded our smocks for vinylon coats and discussed his case as we reclined on the steep escalators that led down into the Pyongyang metro. Notice how our subject's identity shift is near total. The imposter even dreams he is Commander Ga. Notice, too, how he began his story as a love story might open, with beauty and an insight that combined pity with the need to protect. He does not start his story by admitting where he really got this American car. He does not mention that they are driving home from a party hosted by Kim Jong-il, where Ga was assaulted for the amusement of the guests. It slips his mind that he has somehow disposed of the husband of this woman he loves. Yes, we know a few of the facts of Ga's story, the outside of it, if you will. The rumors had been swirling around the capital for weeks. It was the inside we'd have to discover. I could already tell this would be the biggest, most important biography we'd ever write. I could already picture the cover of Commander Ga's biography. I could imagine the subject's true name, whatever that would turn out to be, embossed on the spine. Mentally, I had already finished that book. I was already placing that book on a shelf and turning out the lights and then closing the door to a room where the dust snowed through the darkness at a rate of 3 millimeters per decade.